According to the Pentagon's most recent data, an estimated 8,000 members of the military have deserted or have not reported to duty since the start of the war in Iraq. That's a tiny fraction of the armed forces, and to put it in perspective, way below desertion rates during the war in Vietnam. Besides the numbers, we know relatively little about Iraq-era deserters, who they are, or whether their motives are personal or political or both. For the most part, their options are limited. During the Vietnam War, many draft resistors and deserters went to Canada, but that is much more difficult today. In just a moment, we'll talk with one deserter who left for Canada 2 years ago, whose case for asylum is now making its way through Canadian courts. We'll also explore the issue with a military sociologist and talk with a lawyer about the legal consequences. Later in the program, a conversation with sports writer David Kindred about his new book about Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell, Sound and Fury. But first, going AWOL, we're especially interested to hear from members of the military and veterans today and from those who went AWOL. If you'd like to call in, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And we begin with Jeremy Hinsman, formerly of the 82nd Airborne Division. He and his family now live in Toronto, Canada, where he's seeking asylum, and he joins us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Mr. Connor.
And could you give us an idea of where your case stands at the moment?
Right now, my case is in a low level of the appeal system in Canada. What is at What's at stake is that my case, I think, is becoming more and more about the nature of conscientious objection and less about whatever the reasons were for the U.S. involvement in Iraq. And I'd emphasize that's my case personally. There are other soldiers here who did, in fact, serve in Iraq and came back and then came to Canada. Right now we're awaiting a decision from a judge that will state whether or not we get a new hearing before the Immigration and Refugee Board.
Your previous hearing before the Immigration and Refugee Board, you were rejected.
I was.
Yeah. And how long might this spin out?
I mean, time can tell. I mean, we could conceivably hear an answer tomorrow, or it could be 6 months from now. And that's just this stage. And all we get if we win, if you will, this stage is a new refugee hearing. And the reason we were granted an appeal was because prior to the beginning of our refugee hearing, the Canadian government intervened and stated that the legality of the war in Iraq was irrelevant to my refugee claim.
So you had to shift the basis of your case if you hope to be able to stay. You applied for conscientious objector status when, in fact, as I understand it, when you were in Afghanistan.
No, I actually applied before I was in Afghanistan and before I had any knowledge of a deployment to Afghanistan.
And, the hearing then was in Afghanistan.
The hearing was in Afghanistan.
Okay.
I can explain it in a nutshell. What happened was I enlisted in the Army for a few reasons. I mean, one was kind of the Jerry Maguire show me the money, but also another part of it was that I wanted to be a part of an organization that has some more meaning involved rather than just the ordinary give and take of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enlisted, and I knew that based on U.S. history, every 4 or 5 years we're involved somewhere. It may not necessarily be in war, but it can be some sort of action such as Grenada.
Mm-hmm.
And given that I was enlisting in the airborne infantry, I had no illusions that I wouldn't be deploying somewhere at some point during my enlistment. The issue that I had really started to come about a month into basic training. I joined not with any sort of real bloodlust, but figuring, you know, if I'm in the situation, I can do what I have to do. And I went to basic training, and it's kind of like right now it's a tamed out version of what you see in a Full Metal Jacket.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as hard as it used to be, and it's mainly just playing a game. But about a month into it, I was marching to the chow hall with my company, and we were repeating a chant over and over, which was "Train to kill, kill we will." And our drill sergeants thought our rendition of it wasn't enthusiastic enough, and they threatened us with some extra physical activity. And what happened was I looked all around me, and all my fellow soldiers were getting red in the face, their voices were growing hoarse, and their heads were bobbing up and down, yelling, "Train to kill, kill we will, train to kill, kill we will." And that's just one example of the process of becoming desensitized to what it is you have to do as a soldier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I figured, you know, that would end after basic training.
Yeah.
But it didn't. I got to the 82nd Airborne, whose standard, and it rightfully so, is mm-hmm. that we exceed the standard. And it continued. And what my issue was is that in order to kill, you can't look at the person you're killing as a person. You have to objectify them and dehumanize them, and you got to find some way to do that. I mean, there's a variety of ways, whether it be mm-hmm. racial or religious or you name it, but you have to find a way to objectify them. And that's fine for the enemy, I guess. But you also have to objectify your coworkers. And I became cognizant of this because every time we would go on a training jump, when 100 people jump out of an airplane, statistically, maybe, you know, two or three are going to break something.
Right.
And the person who breaks something, they could have been all laid up as a soldier, you know, and like had no hope. Or they could have been fast track into sergeant. But it didn't matter. They no longer served a function, and they wouldn't be, you know, going out with the boys drinking on Friday night.
No.
And I just wasn't willing to continue living my relational life with what was most of my world, at least 14 hours a day, looking at people as things. And so I applied for conscientious objector status.
We wanted to give listeners a chance to get some questions to you. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with David. David's calling us from San Francisco.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thank you.
I guess my comment is both I agree and disagree with what our last caller was saying. I myself served in the Navy for 8 years as an officer, and also gay, but didn't really come out until, of course, I left the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I personally feel that if you decide to join the military, you know what you're joining for. Obviously, you know, there is a possibility of war. On the other hand, I left right after the war started, after 8 years of service, only because, I didn't join again. So, you know, personally, am I in the, you know, is it my right to judge someone who actually had to face a war where they personally felt that it's something they weren't ready for? Some people do make that decision and later on feel like, it's just not for them. But I guess my final comment would be that if you make that decision, you kind of have to, you know that it's something that you're deciding for a four-year period, eight-year period, you have to stick with that decision. So before someone joins, think very hard about what you're doing.
I suspect, Jeremy Hinsman, you would second that advice, think very hard about what you're doing. But what about David's other point? You knew what you were getting in for.
Well, I think what he's getting at is that there's a sense of honor involved, and you have to live with the consequences of your decision.
I agree.
I completely agree with that. But I don't know, David, if you're aware of the circumstances of my case. I didn't apply for one alpha conscientious objection. I applied for one alpha Oscar conscientious objection, which is to change my military occupational specialty from a combat arms job
to a non-combatant,
to something such as a combat medic. And had I been a combat medic in the 82nd Airborne Division, I would still have been in Iraq. I would have still been seeing the heat. But the one difference is I wouldn't be putting other things or people, hopefully, in my sights and pulling the trigger. And if I was to be shot, you know, that would, it would be horrible for my family. But it's game over for me, and I wouldn't know the difference. And that's fine. My objection
my heart
is to taking human life.
My heart definitely goes out to you, and honestly, I was not put in that position. I flew reconnaissance. I didn't even have a weapon on board. So, honestly, I don't have the right to judge you on that point. But on the other hand, when you join, you have to remember you are government property in a way, and you have to. One question I urge people to always ask themselves before they sign a contract, if you were in that situation, could you kill or, again, be shot at? Hmm. And again, my heart goes out to you because people mature, people evolve, and you. A lot of people have been in the situation where the person they were 2 or 4 years ago was not the person they are at the time, and morally they cannot, they do not agree with killing, or, and a lot of people see this, and I myself saw it as a war. That when I joined, I asked myself the question, would I defend my country when I do these things? Yes. But then, yes, a lot of people got in a situation with this Iraq war. Well, this is not what I had in mind. I don't feel like I'm defending my country. I feel like I'm on a campaign.
If you're in the military, though, you don't get to pick and choose. You get orders.
Correct. Military does not make policy. Congress and the president does. And
I realize that, but I think we...
This is not necessarily what I wanted to die for. If the chance came, mm-hmm. I don't want to die for a campaign. And so, like I said, my heart goes out to you. I had my comment about be sure what you're doing. You have to make sure that that's what you want to do when you join, because in a way, when you sign that paper, you've answered the question. Yes, I will die for my country. I will kill someone if I have to. But again, I was not put in that situation. I flew a plane where we had no weapons. So,
David, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break and take another couple of questions with Jeremy Hinsman. And when we come back from the break, we'll also be talking with military sociologist Charles Moskos and with David Price, a retired Navy JAG lawyer who now represents some people who go AWOL, to talk about what they do, why they do it, and what happens to them when eventually they get caught. I'm Neil Conan, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking with Dave Kindred about his biography, dual biography, of Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell. If you have questions for him, give us a call now, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. But we want to wrap up our conversation about people who desert. To get a sense of the legal options for military deserters, we turn now to David Price, a retired Navy JAG lawyer. He's currently with the law firm McCormick & Associates, who specializes in military law. He's with us by phone from his office in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil, for allowing me to participate in this.
Now, your law firm, I know, receives lots of calls from servicemen who are considering a jumping ship, as it were, and from those who already have. What legal grounds do they have?
Well, Neil, it's very interesting because, of course, they are under an obligation to serve, and they fall into two broad categories. We've got those individuals who are currently on active duty, mm-hmm. and it's just going to be a deployment for them. But the more significant cases that we tend to see are those, the reservists, the National Guard. As Charles just mentioned, there's such a large portion of the troops in Iraq that are reservists, and their cases actually are treated somewhat significantly differently. These are people who, by a large measure, allowed themselves to believe what the recruiters told them, that they'd get college education benefits, and they'd drill once a month and 2 weeks a year, and didn't realize that they actually were going to be mobilized, in some cases on multiple occasions, to deploy for up to a year or two overseas. And as Charles also indicated, the small number of cases, but those that get the most attention, are the conscientious objector cases. The vast majority of the cases are like Sarah from Eugene, her daughter, who has deployed before, but she has something in her personal life that has come up and has now caused her to refuse to deploy. What eventually they face is either obtaining a delay or exemption from being required to mobilize, or eventually that hard choice of show up or face potentially very, very serious administrative or disciplinary action against them.
Mm-hmm. If you turn yourself in, are you better off than if you're found?
Yes, absolutely. One of the aggravating factors in an unauthorized absence case, and as Charles indicated, after a soldier or service member has been gone over 30 days, they are administratively declared to be a deserter. But one of the aggravating factors of a case is, did the service member return voluntarily to military control, or were they apprehended? That's the military term for arrest. Were they apprehended and then returned involuntarily to the military? If they're apprehended, they're much more likely to go into pretrial confinement at the military brig, pending a determination as to how their case is going to be handled, whether it would be perhaps at a lower-level administrative or disciplinary case, then followed by an administrative separation, which will result in a bad paper discharge, typically an other-than-honorable discharge, or they may go to a court-martial. And actually, for a number of reservists and guard who have refused to comply with their mobilization orders, they have found themselves at the highest military court-martial, the general court-martial, which is the military's equivalent of a felony trial, have gotten a conviction, either a bad conduct discharge or a dishonorable discharge, as well as potentially some fairly lengthy periods of confinement.
Mm-hmm. Another factor is how long you may have been in the service?
Absolutely. How long you've been in the service? The military is very good about looking at each offense and each offender. They don't have sentencing guidelines the same as people might be familiar with in the federal civilian court system. They will look at how long you've been in the service, that is, by your years of service, your experience, whether you're officer or enlisted, how senior you are within your different category. And the more junior, the more immature, generally the less severe the consequences are likely to be. But if you've been in for the military for a number of years and you happen to be at a higher pay grade as either officer or enlisted, then those individuals are definitely looking at more severe punishment.
And from your experience, is the military eager to go after people to make examples of them?
Well, generally, no. At this point, they do not normally send out what's called an absentee collection unit to find these individuals and bring them back, although clearly in particular cases that may have obtained some degree of notoriety or publicity, then they may be more likely to do that than others. Mm-hmm. Generally, what happens is that after the individual has been away from the military for over 30 days, they're administratively declared a deserter. Their name and information then goes into the National Crime Information Center. And typically what happens is they're stopped for a traffic offense. The police officer runs their driver's license. They're identified as being a deserter from the military. They're arrested on the spot, taken to the local jail, and then the military authorities are contacted to come and pick them up.
And as we heard earlier, Canada is not much of an option the way it was during Vietnam.
Well, no. And politically, the world is very different than the situation at the end of the Vietnam War.
Thanks very much.
Well, you're welcome, Neil.
David Price, a retired Navy JAG lawyer, now with the law firm McCormick & Associates. He joined us by phone from his office in Virginia Beach. Coming up, Sound and Fury.